Tuesday, November. November 14th, 1972. The following conversation is with Warren Hendricks, a member of Robert Finch's staff. The interview will be held in Mr. Hendricks' office in the old executive office building at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. The interviewer is Terry Good. Again, our questions don't ask or solicit your opinions or your evaluations or appraisals. It's straight factual type questions with the idea in mind that this information will serve the staff at a future Nixon library and researchers who might come in and who are going through files and come across Warren Hendricks' name here and maybe over here and then begin to wonder, well, who was he? What did he do? We'll have a file handy. We can show them and give a very brief and superficial idea of just what your responsibilities are, who you worked with, how long you were on the staff, et cetera, et cetera. And at some point in the future, hopefully, we'll be able to get back to you and do what is known as a true oral history interview, where we sit down and say, okay, could you go into some detail as to your opinions and ideas about the relationship between Mr. Finch and the president, et cetera, et cetera. But that's something that we've postponed for 5, 10, 15 years, so we don't get into it at this point.
I may have to take this one.
That's all right. Well, we can start with the basic questions. When did you join the White House staff?
I joined the White House staff in June of 1970 when Robert Finch left HEW. I accompanied him from HEW to here.
And as far as the last day on the payroll here, sometime December 31st of this year, or?
I think that has to be determined by the president. I've submitted my resignation. When Robert Finch actually leaves here, will be my last day, unless something comes up. You're asking the question, am I going to California or something? I don't know. I think I'm going to stay in the administration.
Okay.
In the meantime, I am going down the inaugural committee to work as the chairman's executive assistant, at the same time work for Finch in a dual capacity.
Your title while on the staff here, did you have any specific...
Our staff has never had a hang-up on titles, and so what we've generally done is just assumed a title as assistant to Councillor Finch, and that's what I've gone by.
Your major role here with Mr. Finch, as explained to us by Bonnie, was as much an advance man as anything else. Now, I'm sure that doesn't encompass everything, but does that give us some sort of an opening that we can start
with? Well, I would not put it in the same terms because I don't consider it an advanced man role. My responsibilities for Finch have been both official and both very personal. I got to be very, very close to him starting at HEW. And generally lined up like this. I would say would be in a role as an administrative assistant, doing those things to take care of him, his family, and a lot of his personal needs that maybe sometimes are not affected by the White House or things that are generated by his job as a member of the cabinet in the White House that have to be done. I don't worry about how much money HEW is going to give to someone else, give to this or that, or substantive areas. It's not been that at all. And under this administrative assistant title has really been all his speaking engagements, both generating them, the ones that come in, filling them, working out all the logistics, all the arrangements for anything he's going to do outside the White House, whether it's on a trip outside the city or if it's just going up to the Shoreham Hotel or to meet with the intergovernmental relations people at some hotel. Find out, make sure we got the briefing material, that it's all together, where he's going to go, what time he's got to be there, and who's going to meet him. And that part, some of the advanced thing would come in, yes. Or when we're going on the road, make sure that you got the airplane reservation for tickets. I would accompany him everywhere he goes. I would generally have advancement out ahead doing the advance. And I would be with him and running my tour director, people have said. And back here, you can't avoid the fact that I got into a lot of political situations his own political thing, California politics. He's been deeply involved in politics, and so many things he would throw at me and say, get a hold of so-and-so and see if we can get him to do this for the president, whatever. So it's a gentleman Friday, not just necessarily an advanced man.
I was wondering if that term might be more appropriate, too. Had you known Mr. Finch prior to HEW?
No. I was a captain in the Army at the time the administration came in. I was working at the inaugural as J. Ward Marriott's military aide, the chairman of the inaugural. After the inauguration, I stayed on as a social aide in the White House and talked to Bob Haldeman, Higbee and people, and General Hughes, and had my resume, and Finch wanted somebody. They sent me up there, and Pat Gray walked me in, and he hired me on the spot. So I was at the right place at the right time.
Do you coordinate Mr. Finch's activities in any way with, let's say, Ron Walker's people and Dwight Chapin's people, Herb Klein and his shop, during the campaign with anybody over at the committee, like John Faust, whose name comes to mind? Or was Mr. Finch pretty much an independent person, traveling where he felt he could best contribute to the administration?
The campaign scheduling, I guess, are you asking just about campaign scheduling?
Well,
right,
we can
now
start there. And
all right. Just for the campaign, he was, quote, scheduled, unquote, by the committee to reelect. The person I dealt with there was Sandy Cram. I was not particularly impressed with the scheduling operation. I did not like the things that they, I didn't think they were coming up with the suitable forums and places for the counselor to go from the great drawing power that he has from both the media and old Republican forces. They weren't plugging him in the right places. Why go to Altoona, Pennsylvania, when he could do a much better job in Pittsburgh or something else with the media? Sure, you go to other little places. Anyway, I was not satisfied. Therefore, they generally did the scheduling, but I went out every way I could, list of convention books to friends that I had along the way, talking to state chairman directly, finally, what could we do to be helpful? And once I found a forum or something that he, I thought he'd like to go to and got some consent or, from him, I would then go to the committee and say, all right, do you have any objections about this? Or approach them some way that they wouldn't get their nose out of joint. John Faust operation, we used his advancement extensively. In fact, I think of very few appearances that we didn't use advancement out of John Faust operation, and Ed Cowling is one person who I worked with very, very closely. As far as the press and media, we did more with the committee than we did with the White House people. Now, prior to the campaign, any appearance in that, I worked very closely, not so much with, well, with Klein Shop and the fact that if you got Al Snyder down there, he'd line up TV shows and things that we could use, or Ken Clausen would line up media people or newspaper people that we could work with. Ron Walker, I very seldom ever had anything to do with Ron Walker in his operation, except being a friend and just talking to him and kidding with him. But it was like Finch's office has been set up in its own independent tour agency. You have Bonnie doing the substantive things. You've got different people plugging in. I got some girl just to work on the invitations for me. We had our own way of getting speeches out to California with Dex machines. We've got TWA Airlines over here that just put anything on an airplane for us anytime, and people and drivers. And so it was our own little operation that we did. I looked at Finch being somewhat different of a surrogate than. Maybe you'd rather wait for that.
Well, that's all right. Go ahead, John.
He was a different surrogate than a lot of the other members of the cabinet, because he didn't have a cabinet to run, a department to run. He was here. His job is a great deal political, and so he had the time to devote and could spend a lot of time out on the road and wouldn't have to just keep crisscrossing back to the White House or back to Washington. And so we had his own little package to sustain him while he was on the road. And it worked very well. It was similar to 70, when in 70 he also went out on the road and did the campaigning, did the congressional campaign.
Did you often schedule appearances for him that came in by way of invitations? Would you come here and speak to this group? Would you come here and speak to us? Or was it more a case of going out and saying, we would like to speak to these people or like to be here or anything like that? Is there any way to break that down, or is that even a meaningful?
Most of the invitations would come, they came in, we would analyze them, see if he wanted to accept them, some good ones or bad ones. friends of his would call and with some good invitations to do. It would be helpful to the president. A lot of the rejects that would come out of Dave Parker for the president or Pat O'Donnell, the official invitation, not the political ones. When they turn them down, they'd send them up here, or they'd call me before they turned them down and ask if, you know, would he consider it? So in the regret letter, they could say that the president regrets he cannot, but he has asked his good friend and counselor, Bob Finch, to represent you if that would be suitable to you all. What we did in going out looking for invitations was more or less Friday, let's see, Wednesday he's going to be in Chicago, Friday's got to be in California. Well, what about Thursday? Why not do something in Denver or Kansas City or something? Don't waste the day. So we'd look through and scramble and see if we couldn't find some convention or something else of good size and merit that would be helpful. And that's the way we'd scout out invitations.
When you say we, do you mean in fact
me?
Yourself? Okay.
Myself, working with people around the White House, saying what's going on, and talking to other cabinet officers, people, and see if they've turned down any invitations recently. That'd be good forms.
So there was a considerable amount of coordination, or at least communication, between this office and other offices within the White House, as well as the cabinet.
Yes. Absolutely. First, we couldn't do any scheduling without first clearing to make sure we're not conflicting with someone else. Then, as far as the information that would come back out of Ehrlichman's shop, all the study and substantive papers, every time Finch would make a political appearance, we would always have the White House send a telegram to that appearance saying, I'm glad that my good friend and counselor Bob Finch can be with you to bring my warmest greetings and to help elect this team, and a telegram from the president had an amazing effect on the crowd. It just warm up an audience like that. And so every political appearance we always had. So we were working with Price's shop downstairs. We're working with the military people and putting in telephones. Everywhere we go, we usually have a phone in for Finch to use direct to the White House.
You speak of some of these appearances as being political, others being non-political. Is there any simple way to break those down? Or my thought on this would be that there's going to be an overlap in every case.
Well, if you're talking like for telegrams?
Well, the appearances that he would make at various spots around the country. You talked about a political appearance.
I said political in regards to a telegram.
And
I'll go farther. But you couldn't send a telegram to an official group probably because that would make it too political, or it would just be a slap in the face. To a political group, you had no problem with a telegram from the president. But you're addressing the National Insured Savings and Loan Association. Why? If they invited the president and he sent a response, that's fine. But if they didn't invite him, why should there be a telegram from him? And so it would have not been his interest in talking to. The invitations that generally we received in the White House from Pat O'Donnell and through Dave Parker were non-political invitations. They were official ones. The political invitations came from 1701. But to define them is just that generally the source, many official appearances were done for political reasons. In fact, anytime any member of the cabinet is addressing a group, it's motivated by political reason, I would think.
Well, I did too. I just wanted to hear your response, so no question.
Certainly.
About it.
If he's out speaking to, in Chicago, to the National Association of Homeowners, he's telling them why, what this administration has done and why they've done such a good job, and certainly it's to help the president.
With his basis in California, one might be inclined to assume that a disproportionate amount of his appearances would be in the West. Is that in fact the case?
I think if you looked at a list of all his appearances between what he's made from whenever you want to start, you're going to see that, yes, a lot of appearances were made not only in the West but in California. And the reason for that is that most of the invitations that he receives come from California. This was different. HEW, they come from all across the country. Now that he's not in the limelight, isn't on TV talking about cyclamates every day or FDA-related problems, he's faded a little. But California invitations have not stopped, and they come in. And Jimmy, yes, he accepts them because they're good invitations. We turn down four times as many as he accepts. But they're from California.
Be any ballpark estimate that you could give on the amount of time he spends outside of Washington, D.C., making appearances as opposed to being here in Washington, D.C.?
Talking on an average, or, we've been in a political year now.
For excluding this political year, going back before that, and then perhaps coming back and giving an estimate on this year?
I would say, except when he's accompanying the president, such as the president takes off in the summer, you know, at that time. I would say he probably averaged about a week and a half out of a month on the road.
And then during this last year?
This last year, I think we've...
It's easier to say how frequently you were here.
We've spent 2 weeks here since maybe June. And it's all been on the road completely.
Who else has traveled with him, both during the campaign year and prior to that?
Recently, traveling with him has been a Dr. Frank Gannon, his White House fellow, now special assistant. Ray Hanslick, the executive assistant, has been traveling. Doris Jones always has traveled since leaving HEW. Bonnie's traveled a little. We've taken some of the girls on trips, advance men. Prior to the White House time, or even after the White House time, during the 70 campaign, was Chuck Lichtenstein, who's now the assistant to Dean Birch, and was the speechwriter then. He was traveling all the time. Mrs. Finch has traveled. And I'm the one person that has been, he has not been to California in 4 years, but I have been with him. I have.
That's quite a record.
Yeah, it really is.
Are you from California?
Not originally. Chicago originally.
So you've gotten to know California quite well.
Very well. I figured the miles he put in last year alone were 200,000. And going back to what you asked about earlier, my role and responsibility, there were two foreign trips that I made. I advanced both of them. The one that he and Rumsfeld made to Europe, 24 countries, 24 cities and 12 countries, to Latin America, to 7 countries. And I advanced both of those.
I wasn't aware of the European trip. I knew
it was in 1971, May and June. And it was an extensive trip. And I did it all commercially. They did it by military.
And when you say you advanced those,
I started out here working on the whole trip, seeing what they wanted to do. Once I knew what they wanted to do, what countries they wanted to go to, and have an outline of how we could do it, we went out to the embassies or through the state and National Security Council saying, all right, here's what they want to do. Here's generally the times we're thinking of. What do you think of these times? They'd come back and say, look good. We'd shuffle around, change things. Then once we decided what it looked like was going to go, I went out and actually did the advance. In Europe, I stayed just ahead of them. In Latin America, I went to all the countries and then started over again once they arrived at the first country.
And you did this by yourself without...
In Europe, I did it all by myself. In Latin America, I had... 2 Secret Service men there and 1 other person to help me finally. And I had 55 people to take care of in Latin America. That every time that Air Force plane landed, 55 people got off that plane.
You know, to hear you tell it, it could be very difficult to sell that job. I don't know how anybody would want it.
Yeah. You work for someone like Finch, you know, you can't help it. He's a great man. It's a wonderful family, and he really takes care of his people. I haven't grown any hair in the process.
How about documentation of all these activities, Warren? As far as all these trips go, would there be something, a file in the files that would contain sufficient information on preparations for the trip, a copy of the speech that he delivered, the people that he corresponded with, or
we'd have
that
to ask,
corresponded with?
We would have to ask Bonnie as far as the speech for each trip. And that generally there is an itinerary for every single trip he's made, except during the 72 campaign we just got going so fast that we did some of it by just off our seats, really, because it just got going so badly that I counted on this in my head to do a lot of it. But as far as generally, we have every speech he's made, and along with the itinerary, along with the correspondence from the people who asked him to speak, along with the thank you notes we sent out afterwards. We generally have sent thank you notes to anyone who was involved in a visit in some way, writing them. And a lot of them are people, not always the head of the organization or something like that, but generally, because we have not used advance men other than political years, I've done it all through the telephone. It's thanking the people who really responded and were standing there and had those bags in the car plain side before you even got out the door, because you know they do it again. And so he wanted to make a very conscious effort of sending anyone who raises a hand a thank you note. And they're not form letters. They're form in the fact that the first paragraph might start out the same, but the second, they're actually written, and he insists on signing them. He won't let a pen do it.
Would your role be fairly well documented in these files, or would it simply be a case of taking this conversation that we're having, listening to it, and then from that deducting what in those files actually relates to your activities?
Well, looking at those files, if there's anything to do with anything but writing the speeches, there's only one person that did it, and that's myself. Now, it doesn't say, you know, Warren Hendricks did this, or it may say accompanied by WKH or something like that, and you'll know I was there. But I can't think of any itinerary that's been written for him in 4 years that I haven't done personally. It's all... No, you just... It's there, and... We tried to make it so he could, if all of a sudden Warren Hendricks did just drop over dead, he could continue on with his thing. And it says, you know, get out of the plane, or it says, you know, arrive so-and-so, proceed to limousine, driver is so-and-so. We've gone so far as to even put the movie of the in-flight movie on the itinerary. Just from wanting to put all the information there.
Is this a skill that you just developed through experience, or was there anything in your military background that prepared you for this?
I spent about 3 years as an aide to a couple generals in the Army in Europe, and it just getting all the information, making it available. I don't think the Army trained me for it. I've learned a lot by watching Ron Walker and his people operate, and just seeing some of their schedules or something, just looking at them to see. You know, I certainly do mine different because I don't think he needs all the things in there that Ron would provide for the President. Just wanting to do a good job and having it all there for the boss so he doesn't have to ask for anything. And making his life as Bob Finch is a person who mine always seemed very he's always seems very preoccupied, always something going on, always thinking about something. And if he doesn't have to ask, he can just look at it and read it and know he's gonna be taken care of. He knows that if I'm there, he's gonna walk off that plane. There'll be some transportation there, and he'll just get in and go on his way. He doesn't have to worry or concern himself with it. He can do a much better job in his own right. And so.
Did you become at all involved in the subject for the speeches that he might give?
No. That's something that's remained with the speechwriter and Bonnie.
Bonnie led me to believe that a good portion of his travel and a large percentage of his interest was related to programs, policies, projects that are the responsibility of HEW. Would you more or less go along with this?
Yeah, he defines his role as counsel to the President that it's anything affecting anything within the 3 mile limit, as opposed to Kissinger, which is beyond the 3 mile limit. And because of that, his roles that he assumed as Secretary of HEW have continued on here. He's gotten involved. People still come to him for these same reasons, and the health, the education, welfare, because of the welfare bill that he proposed. Youth activities were at HEW. The environment was at HEW at one time. And so they continually, this is something he's interested in, health and education, a great deal.
Were there people over at HEW that you worked with more than, let's say, anybody else? Did you have many contacts with other people in other agencies as far as preparing and advancing or doing whatever was necessary for his trips?
No. When we were at HEW or here?
Well, here.
No. If there was a substantive thing to get or something, that some problem that was going on, that someplace we were going and we should be aware of it, Bonnie would do that through her contacts.
Are there magazine or newspaper articles that perhaps shed some light on the operation of Mr. Finch's office, or perhaps of you specifically that come to mind that are...
Me specifically, no. There were more at HEW times than there have been recently. I just remember small articles here or there that Robert Finch and the President were discussing this political or something like that, but I
ask that because on occasion there will be an in-depth study that appears in some magazine or journal that completely goes by us and we know nothing about it. And the people in the office may say, oh yes, in Business Week or something, it was a very extensive article, in-depth article, a good article, and so we can grab that and put it in the files.
Now, I don't think there's anything, been anything really since H.E.W. with Bonnie would be a better one to ask. I don't know if Bonnie got into with you, maybe the reason Robert Finch coming to the White House, why it all happened in the time, but there's been a lot of question about H.E.W. and a lot of people think he was kicked upstairs, that he moved out, that different reasons. I've thought about, and people have asked me before, and something I told him about H.E.W., that as Secretary of H.E.W., he appeared before more committees on the Hill and had, and I'll go into some other thing, had so little time just for that department of time that it's a wonder that he ever used the amount of time he did have for the department, because there was always something else coming up. But as Secretary of H.E.W., he appeared before more committees on the Hill, health, education, welfare, whatever it was.
He had to
go to them all. They all want to talk to the Secretary. He received something like 1,000 pieces of mail a day. His invitations for speaking invitation would probably come in at about the rate of 100 to 200 a day. And the one thing that happened in the beginning of the administration was that the people who could no longer get to the president, where'd they go? They went to see Robert Finch. Because, hi kid.
Call me, would you?
Okay. They would go to Finch because he was the administrative assistant to Richard Nixon. He was the guy closest to him who could get to him and solve their problems right away. He had that department run with a $60 billion budget, and I just don't know when he found time to and travel. And then all of a sudden the president would call up and ask him to go bowling one night or something like that. Oh, I don't know when he had time to do it all. And I personally feel, and I document why he did a good job at H.E.W. But I really believe that the president did want more of his time here at the White House, wanted more of his advice and counsel in other areas, so that he's not just worried about health, education, and welfare. He's involved in the other domestic issues that are necessary to be concerned with. And he can plug in. He's had the experience at H.E.W. And so they brought both he and Schultz into the White House so they could plug into these areas out of the department. So I think it's a good move.
May I ask a question that's related more to Mr. Finch than just your activities? I guess I'm asking for an opinion, and I try not to, without going into great detail. What was his relationship with the domestic council? My thinking on this is that he's involved in domestic affairs. The domestic council, obviously by the name, is involved in domestic affairs.
He's a member of the domestic council.
All right. His activities, his travel, were they in large part coordinated with the staff of the domestic council? Did he draw upon them? Did they draw upon him?
We always used them in a substantive role as far as what they had and what they produced. He used to go every morning to a 7:30 meeting of the domestic council or whatever, with John Ehrlichman and his people, find out, all right, what is happening now? What's happened? What's happened in Congress, this bill and that bill? And from those meetings, he, would help him decide whether he was going to accept some invitations or not. This would really be the way he decided, what is he going to talk about? Is he going to talk about, is he going to jab Congress a little for not doing anything on welfare? Because right now that's what the domestic council wanted to push a little this week. And so I think that's how his subject for his speeches would come about.
Did you attend those meetings?
No.
Really, the last question I have, do you have any idea where we might be able to reach you in 5 or 10 years from now, when, let's say, we'd like to come back and talk to you in more detail and more substance?
Have you really gotten an honest answer from anybody?
Well, now, let me tell you some of the answers we've got. Somebody said, well, I'm an alumni of this university. I'll maintain my contact there. You can get my address through them.
Just say that 5 or 10 years from now, I think that if you'd be able to find Robert Finch a lot easier than me. And if you find him, I think that you'd probably find me somewhere in the vicinity.
Actually, some people will say, look, I intend to continue to correspond with Mr. Nixon for, ever and ever.
Well, I intend to correspond with Finch for a long time, or I wouldn't, of course, with the president, because I don't know him that way. But
are there any professional organizations that you're a member of?
No, I think Ripon College would always be able to find me for it. I did graduate from it. St. John's Military Academy in Delafield, Wisconsin would always be able to find me. No telling.
Do you have a biographical sketch that we can stick in our phone?
I got an old one somewhere. I don't think I have it here. I can get one to you. I don't have it here. I was going to put a resume together here because, like everybody else, I submitted my resignation along with the rest of them. I figured that maybe I'll need it somewhere along the line. But no, I don't have it now. I got it at home, I think, and I'll pull one out and I'll get it to you.
Okay, what we can do is I'll try and write this up in a resume form, send it back to you for your review, comment, editorializing to the degree that you wish, add, subtract, modify, whatever. Send it back to us, and if you can include a biographical sketch at that time, that would complete the file.
There's one thing you might be interested in. I have no idea.
I'll listen to whatever you want to tell me.
Okay. I was a social aide in the White House, in the military, under President Nixon. And if that has interest you at all.
Yes, as a matter of fact, because we have not, if you have the time, we have not interviewed anyone over there in the military aides office, per se, and as a result, we know nothing about the way that's organized or how it operates. If you've got some insights that would shed some light on it, fine.
Well, I wouldn't begin to try to tell you what they do, because I don't think the White House could operate without the military aides office. I'm a strong advocate of the military because of spending 6 years. I was a social aide under President Johnson. I was asked to stay on under President Nixon. Comparing organization, people, personalities, there really is no comparison. President Nixon, his staff, his family, I felt much closer to, much warmer around than I ever did under Johnson. But I was a latecomer under Johnson, too. I don't know. Maybe I just wasn't given the opportunities.
You weren't one of the Chuck Robbs.
That's right, that I was with Nixon. I did accompany the president to all the inaugural activities, balls, with Mr. Marion. And so when I came in as a social aide right after that, again, stayed on, I felt closer than the other social aides did. And maybe that's why I got the chance to do all the introducing for the president. You know, ladies and gentlemen, the president of the United States, and then introduce the receiving lines. And Joan Kennedy came through in her miniskirt once. I stood next to the president and introduced these people. Well, it was a wonderful opportunity for me. I cherish this thought because of...
You've answered part of the question I was going to ask. What does a social aide do? Specifically, in talking about these receiving lines, how does one become familiar enough with the names of the people that are going to be coming through that you can recite them like that without stumbling, without forgetting, without getting them confused? It amazes me.
You ever go through the receiving line, you can see there's a social aide. The social aide stands there next to the president and asks you your name.
Right.
And generally we have the man, or the White House has the man precede the wife, because the president would probably recognize the man first. Or you always think of a woman first. That's not true. We'll put the man first. He gives me his name, and you know, I'll pass him on. I'll say, Senator Baker, and then Mrs. Baker will be right behind him, and I know that, and I'll say, and Mrs. Baker. And then you just got to really remember the one name, again, if his wife's coming. And then standing behind Mrs. Nixon would be another social aide who listens to me tell the president who this is, so he'll repeat to Mrs. Nixon, Senator Baker, and on the way down. There's a social aide there to pull people off and keep moving, because many people in the receiving line want to stand and talk to the president. It depends what kind of reception it is and how long he wants to spend with people and how many hands he has to shake. But a social aide overall, is his job there is to assist the president, the first family, in entertaining their guests. It's a job secondary to his military assignment, but it comes out being a primary thing. It comes first, really. It goes from escorting people in, taking them out, dancing with them, I guess, announcing them. That's the hardest part as far as names go, is that when once a social aide brings, for a state dinner, brings some people upstairs, walks around to the east room where they're going to be, a social aide stands with a microphone to announce the people. He holds a card, and you look at the card, and there you have to pronounce the name. No one's pronouncing it for you. And so you look at the guest list ahead of time and try to go over it. And
this must be pretty rough when there's foreign visitors or dignitaries.
It is, and what they've done is they've used the chief of protocol or someone to introduce the foreign dignitaries to the president, which had the receiving line of the state visit, and then a social aide jumps in and does the rest of the U.S. President's invited guests, other than the official delegation. A social aide, I think, is really can be judged on how much initiative he wants to take to do something. I myself thought I was very aggressive, only because I felt comfortable doing it. So others are not aggressive enough, and therefore some things can fall through the cracks.
How does one become a social aide?
Being at the right place at the right time and being single, and you have to be single. The military, when they have an opening, there may be, five of each service, they have an opening, either you're recommended by someone or they hear about you or your particular service suggests to the White House that you might be to the military aides office, and then if I'm Army, it goes to the Army aide to the President, and he talks to me, he takes me to the social secretary to the President, Lucy Winchester, she interviews you, and then maybe someone else has to interview you now, I don't know, and then if you're acceptable, it takes another 3 months for clearance, and they won't take you unless you've got 18 months left or something like that, because they don't want to go through the process of clearing you and then having you leave right away. And you got to, supposedly you're supposed to be 6 feet tall. And when I was interviewed by Bess Abel, she had me sitting on a couch there. When she stood up, I automatically stand up when a woman stands up. Well, I did. Well, that was one of the tests. She started to light a cigarette, and I pulled her match away and light it. She says, "All right, you're hired." You know, so it just depends who's interviewing you and why.
What's the normal tour of duty for a social aide?
I think your tour in Washington, D.C., if you can manage to stay a while. If you get a job as a social aide, they're not going to move you. They're going to stabilize your tour for a while because they want to keep you. If you're a good social aide, if they don't want you, you might find yourself on orders pretty soon, too. I don't know if it's ever been done. I heard it has. But I would say that I think 2 years would be average enough.
Do you get any special training in social etiquette, manners, or what have you?
No. They have a brochure for social aides, I guess, that out somewhere. You know, it tells you can't have a drink until the president goes upstairs, or you watch the head social aide, and when he takes off his gloves, then you know it's okay to have a drink or to mingle a little with people. And I just think you have to use your own good judgment and not come on too strong and embarrass the president, but yet aggressive enough that you really are helping him.
Is there an age limit in there?
Yeah. They have women social aides now, too. The president's the first one to ever bring on a woman social aide.
Now, on one occasion, I saw a woman over there, I assume was a military aide. Niedecker was dancing with her and enjoying it immensely. I got a big kick out of that. That's the only one I've
There's
ever
one
seen.
From each service, I
Is
think, now.
Right?
In fact, the one from the Army that came in was a major, and she was General Eisenhower's personal nurse just before he died, in fact, when he died. And I guess at the time, that's how it all came about or something. So I remember and asked her if she would want to be a social aide.
But then you're involved in social functions for the entire first family, not just the president alone, but let's say a tea that the first lady might
or if Tricia was going to have a tea at the time, yes, before she was married, sure. It's more of a crowd control thing. Instead of having White House policemen doing it, you've got military there helping, which you don't have it. Same
your job's
people walking around with guns on and things. It's there who are there to supposedly maybe not combat tested veterans, which of course I was. I came directly from Vietnam here, but you don't.
Well, that must have been some change.
Yeah.
it's
a cheap way of labor, but I think it's a very important function for the president. I think it helps him immensely too. Because any other foreign countries that you go to and visit, most of Latin America, of course, all of them, the dictator or the heads of state are all military almost anyway. But it's, I think it's a good idea.
You're both social and security.
Oh no, we're not security at all.
Well, I get the impression that in a way, crowd control is...
Well, crowd control, because how do you get a receiving line going? Is it better to let someone in a nice, shiny uniform do it, or is it better to let a White House policeman come up there with a badge on and do it? Or do you let just some civilians walking around in suits do it? Well, that just is, looks like catch as catch can. Well, it was an exciting time.
Well, I'm sure it must have been. And you had the opportunity to see two different administrations, which I'm sure is a perspective that gives you a great deal more insight and understanding and appreciation for both of them, the strong and the weak points of both.
Now, Mrs. Nixon would walk in, and my last day she walked, or I don't know, somebody must have told her it was my last day, I'm sure, but she walked in, she said, "Oh, you're here, Captain." She said, "You always do it so well, and you remember all those names." Well, I know, and she knows, that I ask the people the names, whether I do it well or not, and I don't know if she says it to everybody. Yeah, it's a nice thing. Yeah. Johnsons would never do that. Hmm. Nixon, at the end of a receiving line, would turn to you and say, nice job, or something. I was thrown into a receiving line under Johnson once. After he kicked the other guy, I says, get him out of here. Right in the middle of the receiving line. And I was thrown in there. He just turned and walked away after that. So you don't know if you did a good job or not.
At least you didn't get fired right in the middle of it, which is... Oh, well, the stories I've heard about Johnson... I don't envy you.
It was a pleasure to work for the president. In fact, just recently, they had a reception down at the Western White House for all the celebrities for the president. And it was political, and therefore they couldn't bring out military social aides. And I was out in California with the counselor, and they asked if I'd come down. And I ran the receiving line for him that day.
Warren, write a book about it all, and let us know ahead of time.
If I was a writer, I think I would.
Anything else you want to say? Again, I don't want to push you on this. I'm tickled to death to sit and listen to somebody talk. I know you're far busier than I am. And one of the other things that we try not to do is burn somebody out the first time around. Because, as I say, 10 years from now, we try and run you down. If you make a bad impression the first time...
I mean, I'm going to know where I can find you 10 years from now?
The Nixon Library.
That's great.
At least that's what we assume. We think there's some advantage to starting here, becoming acquainted with the people while they're on the staff, the organization, the operation complex, and as well as the papers.
Whose payroll are you on?
Actually, National Archives, Office of Presidential Libraries over there. Jack Nesbitt, myself, and Joan Quinn are the three principals in this office here, and I think both Jack and I are going to California. We've got two or three other people on the staff who we just brought on, who I think will also go.
And you think the library will be in California?
Mr. Finch is on the Nixon Foundation. You probably have more insight into that than I do. I have every reason to believe that it will be.
I think you better plan to go to California.
Yeah. I've never been there. I'm from Kansas, so I have no idea what it's like, but everyone says Southern California is a very pleasant place to live. You miss the changes in the seasons of the year, but other than that, it's a far cry better than Washington, D.C. I just personally hope it's not Whittier. From what I've heard of Whittier, that's...
I think you might be close to Orange County, because it's St. Louis.